Good morning. It's not very convincing, but that's okay. I'm going to make it better. God's going to make it better. I'm so glad you're here this morning. We started a new series called Faith and Doubt last week, and we're going through the life of Abraham. And so if you missed last week, I want to encourage you to go to the website, listen to the sermon this week, kind of get caught up a little bit, because that first sermon is really foundational, really for the rest of the life of Abraham and understanding kind of what that initial calling by God was all about. And so I want to encourage you to do that as well. Before we dig into God's word, let's just spend a moment and go to God in prayer and asking him to enlighten us and to speak to us this morning. Dear God, I thank you so much. I thank you that you have given us amazing grace, that you have set us free. But Lord, I just pray that you would help us to understand what that means, help us in our hearts to embrace that godly freedom that you have given us. And Lord, as we look at your word this morning, I pray that your Holy Spirit would enlighten our minds and help us to understand well what you would have for us this morning. And that you would motivate our hearts to embrace that message and apply it fully to our lives. I pray these things in your son's name, Jesus Christ. Amen. Have you ever wanted to just look at somebody and say, stop helping me? Have you, Johnny's like, yes, that was this morning. No, I don't know. I've said that very phrase to many people over my life, I guess. One time that comes to mind several years ago is back, really, I think it was 2008, when we were getting ready to move out here. We were living just for a couple months with my wife's parents as we were kind of in transit, if you will. And my father-in-law was putting on an addition in their living space. They have a pretty unique living situation where it's basically a pole barn, but it's got living quarters in it. And so they were taking the living quarters that they had and they were expanding that. And so I was going to help them with some of that. I have done a little bit of construction in my life and those kinds of things. And so I was going to put up the drywall and finish it and texture it and all that kind of stuff. And I've done a lot of putting up drywall in my life at a professional level. And so I was in there and I was putting up drywall and he was helping me. And it was, it just got to a point, you know, when you've done something at a professional level and then you work with somebody who hasn't, like there's just a drastic difference, right? In how you do things and how you go about things. And so I was getting frustrated, as you might imagine. And it literally came to a point, you know, and we were putting up some pretty big sheets of drywall. It literally got to a point and I loved him, but I literally just looked at Bob and said, Bob, would you stop helping me? It was just one of those things. I literally could do it faster by myself in getting the drywall up, putting it in place, than with his help. It was his intent to help wasn't helpful. And I've said that to my kids over the years, and I'm sure if you're a parent, you've probably at least thought something along those lines with your kids. And there comes a time when you just kind of go, stop helping me. And we'll be more effective. I think God might have been tempted at times with Abram to say the same thing. Abram, stop helping me. And as we look at today's passage, I think what we're going to find is that we all have this tendency, I think, we all kind of want to help God. It's almost as if God has these plans and he's promised all these things. And as we kind of go through life, we kind of go, God, you're not doing so good, man. Let me help you out. Have you ever found yourself in that spot? Maybe you haven't literally said that or literally had that exact thought, but you've probably had that behavior in your life, even if you haven't said that to God. I think God probably was tempted to say that to Abram in the story that we're going to look at today. But I want to recap kind of where we were last week to where we are today, because it's important in how we understand the text we're going to look at today. Because God pulled Abram... I told you last week, I might say Abraham, but I know his name was changed later. Just, you know, forgive me for that. Because we always, we sing, right? Father Abraham. You guys know that one, right? Okay, just say. So it's ingrained in our minds. But his Abram, God pulled Abram out of Ur. And Ur was kind of the happening place. It was the epicenter of culture at the time. It was the place where all the enlightened were, and the enlightened worshipped many gods, but especially the moon god Sin, and he had come out of this context, this very secular, pluralistic kind of context, and God calls him and says, Abram, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to make you a great nation, and I'm going to make your name great, and all these different things. And he gives Abram this blessing, but there's a little bit of a catch, because you're going to go to a land that I will show you. In other words, I'm not telling you all the details. I'm not giving you all the information you might want, but I'm going to call you away from everything you've known. I'm going to call you away from the nation that you've known, the people that you've known, the family that you've known. I'm calling you out of all of that, and I'm calling you to something greater, a promise that I'm going to give to you, a blessing. I'm going to bless you so that you can be a blessing to the nations. And so God calls Abram out of this place, out of this totally different culture, and really probably had to in order for Abram to really embrace what God was going to make him into at some point. But it was going to take time. To Abram's credit, right? He responded in faith. He says, okay, God, you've called me. I'm going to go. Even though I don't have all the details, I'm going to go. You're going to show me the land. And God does. He shows him the land. And Abram dedicates that land to him and worships him in those places. And kind of outlines. He becomes God's land surveyor, if you will. And he puts up these altars and worships God in the land that God is going to give him. And as we ended last week in verse 9, God is bringing him down to a place called Negev. The letter for V and B is the same letter in Hebrew, so you'll see it both ways. You'll see Negev with a B on the end or Negev with a V on the end. And so he calls him down to this place, and that's kind of where we pick up the story. In verse 10 of chapter 12 of Genesis, it says this: Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. They will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. Now, this is a really interesting text that as we look at this today, and we kind of have this situation, and those of you who have been around the church maybe have heard this story and are somewhat familiar with it, and it's really kind of an odd situation as we look at it thousands of years later. You know, what was Abraham thinking? And furthermore, wasn't she in like her 60s or something like that? And let's just be honest, you know, when we come to our 60s, our appearance probably isn't what it was when we were 25. Or 30, right? And so we have this kind of weird thing where Abram's saying, you're this beautiful woman and my life is really threatened because of your beauty, but she's in her 60s, and we kind of put that in our minds, and it doesn't seem to make sense. But the reality is that people aged a little bit different at that time. She was probably really more akin to being in her 30s or 40s at the time, just based on the difference in how people aged. And so she was a beautiful woman, and Abram comes, and he arrives at the land that God has shown him, and then he has this reaction because there's a famine in the land. As a matter of fact, I would suggest this, that sometimes God's promises fail to meet our expectations. I know that sounds weird, doesn't it? Some of you are reading that and go, what? Wait, God doesn't live up to our expectations? I think that's true. Sometimes God's promises fail to live up to our expectations. And I think that's exactly what happened with Abram. Let's put the story in context. God pulls him out of this area, this epicenter of culture, the center of all things that are great and wonderful in the known world of that day. And he brings him to this other place. It's kind of Hickville. It's not quite what he had been used to, what he had experienced. His travels likely brought him through something known as the Fertile Crescent, and it was beautiful, and it was lush, and there was plenty of food, and agriculture was all over the place. And God calls him to these different places, and he sets up the altar, and he's dedicating this land to God. And initially, Abram's going, this is great. This is all going to be the land that God's going to give me for the nation that he's going to make me into, and the name that he's going to make me into. This is what he's giving me. But his last stop is a place called Negev. And Negev literally means dry land. This is the Negev right here. This is a picture of it. Now, if you look really, really close, there is a little bit of green in that picture. You can see it, right? Just a little bit of green kind of along that, well, it's probably a riverbed there. And you go, what in the world? And so all of a sudden you come to this place and you see this and you're going, is this what you're giving me, God? What am I going to do with this? This is not the beautiful, lush place that I've come from and I've traveled through. And what is going on? This area is like a, it's not quite desert, but it's really close. They get some rainfall every year, but it's very minimal. And so you can imagine as Abram travels to the southern part of the land that God would give him, and this is what greets him, and all of a sudden, whatever vegetation was there, which wasn't much in the first place, isn't there anymore. There's a famine. But it's kind of close to Egypt, and Egypt has plenty of food. And so Abram, in his wisdom, or maybe lack thereof, as the case might be, decides, I'm going to go to Egypt. And so he heads off to Egypt, and on his way to Egypt, he begins to think about where he's going. Now, this is, you know, travel's something different at this time in history, right? This isn't jump on a jet plane and go visit a different part of the world. The technology that we have, the ability that we have to go from one place to another is so foreign. You know, traveling just through the promised land that God would give him and God showing him that was a significant, it took a significant effort. Now he's going to go into another place that he's never been, a foreign land that maybe other people are going to, right? They're experiencing the same famine, and they're trying to deal with it however they can. And so maybe there's a group of people, and they're going, you know, Egypt's not far away. We've heard, you know, my friend's buddy who lives over there, whose buddy lives over there, whose buddy lives over there, heard that there's plenty of food in Egypt. Let's all go to Egypt. And so Abram gets up and he goes to Egypt, but on the way, he starts to realize that he's going into a new culture. He starts to realize that he's going to be the foreigner. Maybe he starts to realize that God didn't seem to say anything about going to Egypt. This doesn't seem to be what God's plan was for me. If you go back to the opening verses of chapter 12, and you look at what God said to him, he said, go to the land, I will show you. But God isn't showing me Egypt. I've kind of reacted to a circumstance. So Abram goes to Egypt. He leaves this dry land that we see here. As a matter of fact, in other places in scriptures, it gives hints about what this context was like. In Psalm 126, verse 4, it says, restore fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. I don't know what that is. That's not it. That's okay. But in Psalm 126, it says, restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. In other words, streams in the Negev were the life source because everything else was just dead. It was dead. It was a dry place. And so Abram, on the way to Egypt, he's leaving this dry place, trying to go to find some food so that he can support his family and the people that have followed him. As you remember, there's many that followed him from Haran, people and other things. And so he had a group of people that were traveling with him. And he comes up with this story. And he says, Sarai, you're beautiful, you're gorgeous, and I've also heard, although I've heard there's food there, I've heard that there's human trafficking taking place on a significant level, and we're going to be the foreigners. In other words, not only are you in danger of being taken and abducted, but I'm in danger of being killed because who would miss me? Because I'm the foreigner. I'm the person in a foreign land. I'm the refugee. I'm the one that's coming to a new place to find food because the old place didn't have any. And so Sarai, you're beautiful. And so let's have a different story. Instead of you being my wife and risking the possibility that you might be abducted or taken and I might be killed so that they can cover up the crime that's taking place, you just tell people you're my sister. And he was taking advantage of a cultural practice that if there was no father, a woman had a brother, for marriage, they would negotiate with the brother. And so he was kind of taking advantage of this custom and saying, hey, they'll have to come to me and they'll have to negotiate with me. And at least if that happens, then we've got a heads up and maybe we can escape during that time. Maybe that gives us an opportunity to get out of here so that nothing bad happens. And so that's maybe his plans, and so he comes to Egypt, and he's come up with this plan, and I want you to notice something. Abram didn't ask God what he should do. Did you notice that? He didn't say, hey, God, there's a famine in the land. What should I do? He just said, let's go to Egypt like everybody else. And on his way to Egypt, he realizes that there was inherent danger. And that his wife's life and his life could be in danger. So they come up with this plan. In other words, God's promises didn't meet Abraham's expectations. And I think that happens a lot in our lives too, because we go along and we say, I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm going to follow God. I'm going to do what he says. And when I do that, then all the problems that I have will be taken away. I mean, after all, didn't Jesus say, I've come that you may have life and have it what? More abundantly, right? He's come that we might have a more abundant life. And preachers preach that, because guess what? That preaches, man. People like that message. And so preachers get up and they say, Jesus has come that you may have life and have it more abundantly. You will have a new life, as it talks about in Corinthians, and you'll be a new creation, and your life will be changed forever. And I believe 100% all of those things are true. But sometimes what happens is this. People will respond to that message and will say, I'm going to follow Jesus and he's going to give me a new life. And maybe they've come out of addiction or relational strife or financial difficulty or whatever the difficulties in this world have presented to them. And they've fallen into the traps and the snares that of the difficulties of this world. And they've come out of this and they see hope in Jesus Christ. And they should. You should see hope in Jesus Christ. But sometimes we place our own expectations on what that hope should look like. And so what they do is they respond to the message of Jesus Christ, which is a great and wonderful thing, a thing that should be celebrated. And they go, I'm going to follow Jesus because I heard that life abundantly thing and that new creation thing and that it's going to change my life. So I'm going to give my life fully to Jesus. And they embrace Jesus and they embrace the gospel message and all that it is and all the good news that it brings. And then they get a week into it and all of a sudden they tell their closest friends and relatives about this great thing that's happened in their life, and all of a sudden their friends and their relatives are going, are you crazy? Are you dumb? I can't believe you did that. I can't believe you fell for that religion stuff. Wow, that didn't go like I thought it would. That conversation was different in my mind. And I thought my family and my friends would just hear the hope that I found and they'd be excited and they'd follow Jesus too. Or they've been struggling with an addiction of some kind, whether it's drugs or alcohol or sex or something else that is kind of taking control of their life. And they thought, well, when I follow Jesus, that'll just be gone. Because they heard a testimony about that or something like that. And they follow Jesus and all of a sudden they still are facing those same difficulties and those same temptations. And they're still tempted to fall prey to the same traps that they've fallen prey to for a long time. And they're sitting there going, where's the promised land, God? How come you haven't taken away all of those things that you said you were going to take away? Where's this life more abundantly that you promised me? And God's promises don't look like they thought they would look. Because sometimes God does do miraculous things in our lives. Sometimes God does instantly take away things like addiction or things like relational strife, and he heals relationships. And sometimes it's in a moment, it's in an instant. And sometimes people will go to their family and their friends and they'll start to talk about Jesus and this hope that they found, and their family and their friends will respond and they'll go, wow, God's amazing. And sometimes God leaves those things, those strifes, those difficulties in place because he's trying to do something in our character. He's trying to help us become something that we are not yet. Sometimes it's a sanctification process. Sometimes it's the process of God saying, look, you need to deal with these things, and it's going to be hard and it's going to be difficulty, but in the midst of that hurt and in the midst of that difficulty, I'm going to make you into something new. I'm going to make you, bring you closer to being more like Christ. And so the promised land doesn't look like we wanted it to look, like we thought it would look. And I think that's what Abram was experiencing. And so we begin to think, okay, God, well, you apparently need a little bit of my help. And so I'm going to help you out. And we begin to make plans on our own. And I think that's exactly what happened with Abram. All of a sudden, you see Abram going the famous Abraham that was declared righteous because of his faith and is included in Hebrews 11 as one of the preachers and theologians like to call Hebrews 11 the hall of faith, like the hall of fame, but the hall of faith because it's all a chapter about faith and the faithfulness of people that had gone before. And Abraham is one of the main characters that it looks back to, and Paul mentions him in Galatians and Romans as this great character who exemplifies faith. But as you read the story, last week he was full of faith, and this week he's full of doubt. It's not the famous faith for which Abram was known. See, Abram did not put God in the driver's seat. I don't know if you've ever taught somebody how to drive. I've had the privilege of doing that multiple times, actually, but with my daughter, and in a couple years with my son, probably. I don't know if you've been in the passenger seat and sitting there, and you put the person who's learning how to drive for the first time in the driver's seat, and it's especially fun if they've never really driven anything, like they've never driven a go-kart or a lawn tractor or something like that. Then it's really fun, right? You put them in the driver's seat. And I have, when I taught my daughter how to drive, I had a conversation with her, and I said to her this. I go, here's what's going to happen. You're going to start driving, and at some point, I'm going to yell at you, and you're going to cry. Like, this is what will happen. And you think I'm making this up, but I really am not. I literally told her this. Because I knew this was going to be the case, right? Because I knew that she was going to begin to drive, and she'd driven a few things, but not very many. I grew up driving like go-karts and tractors and like big tractors, like farm tractors and different things like that since I was like 5 years old. And so when I learned how to drive a car, I scared my parents for other reasons. I was maybe a little too comfortable with driving, you know? But she was not comfortable at all. As a matter of fact, I had to basically force her to learn how to drive. And so I just told her, I go, look, you're going to start driving, and then I'm going to yell at you, and you're going to cry. And then we'll get over it, and we'll can do it, and we might repeat that process 3 or 4 times. And so I told her this, and this is exactly what happened. I put her in the driver's seat. We start in parking lots, empty ones, right? I mean, they have curbs and light poles in them, but you still have things to watch out for, but no other cars. And so I put her in the car, and we begin to drive around the parking lot, and it was not very long before I was like, stop, stop. You know, I'm kind of being nice to the mic here, but it was much louder probably. You know, I'm like, stop. Why? Because she's gonna hit something. She doesn't know how to steer, and we went over all the controls. She knew where the stop was, and then you start thinking, I wonder if she's gonna hit the gas instead, right? And that's what goes through your mind because it's all new, even though you explained where it was. And what do you think she did? She cried. We had a great father-daughter moment. Sometimes that's got to be what God feels like. We'll kind of put God in the driver's seat, but we'll just say, but we want to drive one of those driver's ed cars where we have the brakes and a steering wheel too. And the reality is God knows what he's doing, and we're the ones who don't know what we're doing. We don't understand what God is accomplishing, the big picture of what God is doing in our lives or in other people's lives. And so all of a sudden, God starts driving, and we grab the steering wheel, and we yank it. Or maybe we reach over. You've probably done this if you've taught somebody how to drive, especially once you get on the actual road, and they start going some direction, and you grab the steering wheel, and you correct. And sometimes we do that to God. We grab the steering wheel, which we gave him, and we correct. We put ourselves in the driver's seat instead of allowing God to drive. The story goes on, though, in verse 14 of chapter 12. And it says this: when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that Sarai was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. He treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle and male and female donkeys, male and female servants, and camels. Now, just a side note, that the camels is kind of a weird mention there, and if you want to know more about that, you should listen to last week's podcast, because we talked about it, and why it's there, and why that's an issue. But so he's given all these things, right? Now, I want you to understand something. Here's what happened. Abram comes to Egypt. He makes up this little lie, right? And he says, say you're my sister to protect you, to protect me, to protect our people, the people that are with us. And so, and she's very beautiful. And so she gets there. People see that she's very beautiful. They mention it to the officials, who mention it to Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, I want her. Go get her. So they bring her into the palace. They give Abram all of this stuff and all of these animals and all of these people, these servants. And do you see an exchange taking place here? Does this sound at all to you like an indecent proposal? Because that's what it sounds like to me. When I read that, that's exactly what it sounds like. Abram, we want your sister to come into the palace, but we'll give you all this stuff. Now, I want you to notice something, that in the text, Abram doesn't fight the whole process. He takes the stuff and the people and the animals. He takes it all. And she goes into the palace. Now, here's what's amazing about this whole thing is, as you read it, and again, this is going to go contrary, and this is going to offend our sense of justice, our sense of right and wrong, and it should. But this, I want you to notice this, that Abram's lie leads to blessing. Did you notice that in the text? Because that's what it reads like to me. As I look at the text, and Abram makes up this lie, and his wife is now taken into the palace of another man. Now, I want to tell you, scholars disagree on what may or may not have actually happened in that context, and I'm not going to weigh in too strongly on one side or the other. Some scholars think that there was no actual adultery that took place, and other scholars think there absolutely was, and they both state their case pretty strongly. I think there probably was. That's kind of where I lean, but either way, she's in danger. She is out of Abraham's household. He is not living up to his duties as a husband. He is not protecting her. He is not keeping her safe. He has failed in that responsibility as it is related to his wife, no matter what the case might be regarding whether adultery actually took place or not. But Abraham's lie leads to blessing, because all of a sudden, Abraham's a rich man. All of a sudden, he's got all this stuff. He's been given all these gifts, all these animals, all these servants. And really, this exotic animal, the camel at that time, And so all of a sudden, he's wealthy, right? He's got some kind of status, at least when it comes to financial types of issues. And so he receives at least a financial kind of blessing in this whole process. Let's review for a second Abram's mistakes, okay? Let's look at those. The first one is this. Abram leaves God's promised land without seeking God's will or trusting that he will provide in the land he promised to give to Abraham. So Abram goes into the land. He says, you know, God's given him this land. God's shown him the land. And all of a sudden, he hits a little bit of a rough spot. It's hard times. And so what does he do? Does he seek God's will? No. Does he try to figure out what God wanted him to do? No. What does he do? He reacts. And what he believes is human wisdom. And he says, I am going to Egypt. And he takes off to Egypt. Mistake number two. Abram lies about his wife to protect himself. Do you remember how the text was phrased? Sarai, you tell people that you're my sister so that it might go well with who? Me. That it might go well with me. Now, I'm not saying that he didn't include her in that, but do you sense a little bit of self-centeredness in the way that that was spoken and written? I certainly do. Abram lies about his wife to protect himself, which leads to the last thing. Abraham seems to receive gifts for the taking of his sister into the palace. So mistake number one, he doesn't seek God's will and he leaves the land that God had promised him, which leads to mistake number two. Abram lies about his wife to protect himself, which leads to mistake number three. Abram seems to receive gifts, so he accepts the gifts for the taking of his sister into the palace. Do you see what happens here? When we turn away from God, when we don't seek his will, when we don't follow him, it's lie or sin upon sin upon sin, which leads to another sin, and we end up going down this little path, don't we? Abram certainly did. One thing led to another. And in the midst of it, he gets rich. In the midst of all of this, he gets rich. It seems that Abram was blessed in spite of his bad acting. Indeed, there's a certain truth that Abraham became wealthy, even receiving camels, which is a rare thing at that time in history, to have domesticated camels. In other words, our sense of justice is offended because what we do is we look at this and we look at this in the world too, as we look out at the world and we see other people who are bad actors and yet they seem to be blessed. Everything they do seems to work. They get wealthy, whatever. And from a distance, we look at them and go, wow, why is it that people who do those kinds of things, why is it that the people who sin, the people who don't follow God, the people who seem to cheat and lie and all of those kinds of things, why do they seem to be the ones that are successful? And we look at Abram and we go, why is it that Abram doesn't seek God? He doesn't stay in the land that God has promised him. He leaves, he goes to Egypt, then he lies about who his relationship to his wife. By the way, it was only a little lie. Because she really was his sister if you go to Genesis chapter 20. I don't know if you knew that or not. But if, once you get to Genesis chapter 20, you find out, oh, she is his at least half-sister. And so she's his half sister. So it's just a little lie. It's not a complete lie. Like, it's not that there was no truth at all in what he said, but he deceived nonetheless. And what is a lie intended to do? Deceive, right? So he lies about that relationship, and then he takes gifts in this indecent proposal kind of way, and he's doing all of these things, and yet in the midst of it all, he is blessed. The reality is this. If God were to give us all that we deserved, we would all be cursed and never blessed, wouldn't we? See, that's the truth that we forget. See, we look at Abram and we go, how in the world is he blessed in spite of his sin after sin after sin? We go, man, I'm not as bad as Abram. I haven't cheated my way to wealth. I certainly haven't told my wife to tell other people, and I have a beautiful wife, I think, anyways, and you don't have to agree, but you're wrong. And so, so I haven't gone around and said, hey, honey, just tell people you're my sister. That way, you know, that way it'll go well with me. Like, I haven't done that. Have I done that? I haven't done that. She's laughing. I'm not sure why. I'm trying to remember if I have, but I haven't. Right? Like, I haven't done the things that Abram did. And yet, I'm not wealthy. I'm not rich. I'm not driving around in a brand new Mercedes. I don't live in the super upscale part of town. And I don't have people that, you know, I don't have, you know, hey, have your people call my people. Like, I don't really have that kind of thing. Like, I don't have people like that. Like what? Why? Why is it that when I look around the world, that other people seem to have these things? And this is what we need to understand, that God's economy is not our economy. And I am so thankful for that, because when I begin to look in the mirror and take an honest assessment of my life, the decisions I've made, the things I've said, the thoughts I've had, when I take that honest assessment and I compare it to the righteousness of God, I find that I have what? Fallen far short. And that what I deserve is not blessing, but curse. I deserve to be cursed. And if you're honest, so do you. And so when we begin to get into that comparison game, and then we go, well, that person's not as good as me, why hasn't God blessed me? Because God doesn't bless based on merit. He blesses in order to accomplish his will and his purposes. His economy is not our economy. How often do we treat God like a genie in the bottle, thinking that somehow he owes us because we're not as bad as that person, but we're bad enough, aren't we? The truth is this: God owes us nothing, but he gives us blessing. The reality is that you have been blessed. If by nothing else, you have been blessed to know the person of Jesus Christ, to know the sacrifice that he paid, to know the blood he shed, so that you could be made righteous, so that one day you would live in a new heaven and a new earth, and you would be before God, and you would be with God, and you would be declared righteous, and you would have true hope that will last for an eternity. If you have been blessed in no other way, you have been blessed by hearing that today. God has given us blessing. However, we should never think that our actions don't have consequences. Did Abram's actions have consequences? You think? You think they didn't? Come on, man. I mean, you look at, as we go through Abram's life, and I'll give you a sneak preview. He's going to do this again. Like he's not that smart, all right? But he experienced consequences. Can you imagine being in that situation, the strife that must have caused between him and his wife? The difficulty in their relationship that they must have had? Now, she seems to be silent, and she seems to be complicit, at least as the text portrays it. But I promise you that there are consequences to this and that he experienced them. Can you imagine if her relationship with Pharaoh was consummated, what that might have done to their relationship, to their love for one another? The story's not over yet, though. In verse 17, it goes on, and it says this, "But the Lord inflicted serious disease on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife, Sarai. So Pharaoh summoned Abram. 'What have you done to me?' he said. Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her to be my wife?" That's the phrase, by the way, that people look at and say, "No, that was consummated because of that phrase, so that I took her to be my wife. Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go," Pharaoh says. And in verse 20, "Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had." In other words, here's Pharaoh, and he goes, "You lied to me, and I'm suffering the consequences." And again, we go, "What? Why is that fair?" That's not right. Our sense of justice speaks up, and we go, "That does not seem fair for this plague to be sent to Pharaoh's house. He didn't know what was happening. He was lied to. He's the victim. Why would this be done?" But do you remember the original promise? Because we need to recognize this, that God's promises are not merit-based. God's promises are not merit-based. Do you remember the promise in chapter 12 and verse 3? It says this, "I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So here's what happens. So Abram goes in the land. "This is my sister, not my wife." Pharaoh takes her into the household, gives Abraham a bunch of gifts, and then God sends a plague onto Pharaoh and his household, and all of a sudden they are dealing with this significant disease, and all of a sudden it comes to light that Abram lied about who Sarai was, and Pharaoh's mad at Abram, and he says, "No, take her and go." But you might wonder, if you take a little bit of time to think about this, why Pharaoh wouldn't just kill Abram and keep her. Like, why didn't he just do that? I mean, Abram had wronged him. That certainly wouldn't have been out of character for a Pharaoh to do. Have you ever thought that maybe it was because of the curse of the plague that God sent on his household? In other words, God kept his promise even though Pharaoh might not have known. He was still wrong. He was still sinning. It might have been out of ignorance, but ignorance is what? No excuse. Ignorance is no excuse. We might not like it. We might say it doesn't seem fair. We might say it's not just. But God is just in a way that we cannot understand. And God brings this disease upon Pharaoh and his household, and maybe the one reason why Pharaoh didn't go and kill Abram is because he felt the power of Abram's God. And he said, "I am not going to mess with that." So God was keeping his promise even though Abram wasn't faithful. God kept his promise. Abram comes to Egypt seeking refuge from a famine that left him and his family hungry, right? Pharaoh and other Egyptians take advantage of the foreigners, the refugees, in the same manner that they took advantage of Abram. Well, Abram's tactics and lack of trust in God left him guilty. Pharaoh and the people of Egypt were guilty of being bad hosts. Sometimes we forget that. Remember, there was probably a practice of this. Why did Abram come up with the lie? Because he knew that there was a practice of this kind of behavior from those people. Was the disease that came upon Pharaoh, was that part of God's judgment on Pharaoh, even if it wasn't specifically for Sarai, but for the practice that was taking place in Egypt? We see that throughout the Old Testament where God judges nations because of their bad behavior using other nations or other people. I think that does happen here. And all of a sudden you begin to go, oh, wait a minute, maybe God is just. Because maybe this was a common practice. And maybe God was bringing judgment upon Pharaoh's household. Because they were being bad hosts and taking advantage of refugees, people from out of town, foreigners who had come into their land. God judges Pharaoh and once again blesses Abram by sending a plague. Pharaoh might have just killed Abram if he had not recognized the power of God behind Abram. So what are we supposed to take from all this? Here's what you're supposed to take. You ready? Here it comes. So you forget everything else. Wake up. I know you've been sleeping, right? Wake up and hear this. God doesn't need our help, but he wants our trust. God doesn't need our help, but he wants our trust. I want to tell you about Edelman. Edelman's a leading global communications marketing firm. And every year they do a trust barometer report, and they've done one for 2018. And here's what they said. Here's what came out in their report. Trust in the U.S. has suffered the largest ever recorded drop in the survey's history among the general population. Trust among the general population fell 9 points to 43%, placing it low in the lower quarter of the 28-country trust index. The collapse of trust in the U.S. is driven by a staggering, listen to this one, and I love this one, lack of faith in the government, which fell 14 points to nearly 33%. The remaining institutions, and I went and read the report, and the main one after government that has a lack of trust, media. Can you imagine? And NGOs also experienced declines of 10 to 20 points. Here's their conclusion summed up. The United States is enduring an unprecedented crisis of trust, said Richard Edelman, president and CEO of Edelman. This is the first time that a massive drop in trust has not been linked to a pressing economic issue or catastrophe. In fact, it's the ultimate irony that it's happening at a time of prosperity with the stock market and employment rates in the U.S. at record highs and lows, as the case may be. But here's the reality. As you look at the last year, you realize that the church has also lost people's trust at times, hasn't it? You know, I begin to say names like Bill Hybels, who's trusted in many ways for many, many years, and allegations of inappropriate relationships came out this past year with Bill Hybels. And there's other names too, and over the past years, and some of them are big names and some of them are not big names, and the church has often lost its trust, even if it's not because of its leaders and because those who have fallen in a leadership perspective. Maybe it's simply because people look at the church and go, what do we need you for? You're not being effective. You're not really doing the things that the church ought to do. You're not ministering to the poor. You're not accomplishing the things. As a matter of fact, we now have a reputation of being hateful in some cases towards certain groups of people. Trust has been lost in the church as well. And it's difficult. And we look back at Abram, and we look back at the bad actions of Abram and the lies he told and the decisions he made, and we go, wow, things really haven't changed that much, have they? Even the people of God still continue to fall and to make bad decisions. Even if at times the church has broken trust, even if at times leaders in the church have broken trust, God has never broken trust. He deserves our faith and our trust. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9 reminds us of this. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promises, as some understand slowness. Instead, he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. In other words, God's timing is different than ours. God's promises are fulfilled according to his will, according to his time, and they are, his will and his time are better than ours. And that's the truth we must recognize. Galatians 3:16 says, the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. Scripture does not say and to seeds, meaning many people, but and to your seed, meaning one person who is Christ. In other words, the ultimate fulfillment of God's promise is Jesus. It's Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of Abram's promise. The blood on the cross that was shed for the forgiveness of sins is the fulfillment of Abram's promise. The ultimate fulfillment of the promised land is not landmarks that can be traced back to Israel, but a new heavens and a new earth that we will all receive at some point in eternity future. See, God does not need our help, but he wants our trust. And that's what it boils down to, isn't it? It's refreshing to me to read the story of Abram, this man of great faith that the Bible celebrates, and realize that he didn't always have great faith at every moment, because you know what? Neither do I. So I pray, God, help me in my unbelief. Help me in my doubts that I might have great faith in the cross and the promises that you've given. Amen? Let's pray. Dear God, thank you so much for your love and mercy and grace in our life.